at macfound.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. First, a news update. A large hole is formed outside of a Tarpon Springs High School, and officials there say the pit was seen next to the Culinary Arts Building. It began sometime this morning. Pinellas County Schools say the district is working with city officials to investigate the incident and that the students and staff are being told to avoid the area. So far, everybody's safe. Students at the Culinary Arts Building in Tarpon Springs have been moved to a different part of the campus. Well, good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. In a moment, we'll talk with Paul Wilborn about his new book about Tampa's Ybor City in the 1980s, when Ybor was a much different place than it is today. But first, one listener comment about yesterday's program. On that program, we discussed President Trump's promises and the support he continues to receive from about 35% to 45% of Americans. Here's what one listener had to say.
Stephen at St. Pete, and I wanted to make a comment on one of the callers that talked about how Trump voters oppose themselves. People demographically that are poor or middle class, put a scenario to them. They have an injury. They have a sickness. They become disabled. They lose their job. They go through their finances. The major medical policy that they have with $1 million cap, and there are millions of these policies still out there on the books, stops paying. All of a sudden, they're faced with poverty. You think that they're going to apply for Medicare, possibly, Medicaid, Social Security, disability, food stamps, unemployment benefits, welfare programs that are there to help the working poor and to help the poor. They are going to turn to those programs. And here's what's the irony of this. They vote for a party that reviles those programs.
There's a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Music there from Perez Prado, and that's the kind of music that you once could hear in Ybor City. Our guest today is Paul Wilborn, a former newspaper reporter, a musician, a one-time TV personality, and currently the executive director of the Palladium Performance Space in St. Petersburg. Paul has written a new collection of fiction called Cigar City, Tales from a 1980s Creative Ghetto, about Ybor City, Tampa's Latin Quarter, that was vastly different then than what it is today. And Paul Wilborn, welcome back to WMNF. Nice to see you.
Rob, great to see you. Great to be here. Thanks.
All right, so set the scene for us. What was Ybor City like in the late 1970s, early 1980s? How does it differ from what we see over there today?
Well, we didn't have guns, but had we had one, you could have shot it down 7th Avenue after 7 o'clock at night and not hit anyone.
It's hard to believe because it is so crowded with people almost all hours of the day.
It was empty, and that was kind of a gift, I think, that it was. My family were Sicilian immigrants. My great-grandparents came to Ybor at the turn of the century.
Were they cigar workers?
They were cigar workers. They quickly, like many Italians, moved out of the cigar industry into groceries. They became dairy farmers. But my great-grandmother rolled cigars for a long time. So Ybor, I knew it from my childhood as the sort of immigrant enclave, but by the time I got out of college, everybody had left. Urban renewal had stripped it away. There was just these shell buildings left. And artists started moving in.
Well, the peak period, I think, I dare to say, for Ybor is probably late 1890s, right up to the 1950s, and whenever I-4 went in, right?
It started to decline, really, in the 60s, and cigarettes replaced cigars. People started moving to the suburbs. There were just so many reasons why these urban, down to every place, cities just cleared out, and Ybor was certainly no exception. And urban renewal was kind of this misguided effort to, I think, move poor people out of the district. And there were talks of doing bullfighting there, all sorts of crazy ideas. But what they really left was this urban, authentic place with lots of spaces to rent, and artists started moving in.
The good thing was they didn't tear down many buildings on 7th Avenue, so it became cheap for artists to move in. So talk about some of the artists that you knew back then in the 1970s and 80s. What kind of people were moving into Ybor?
You know, when I got there, there was already a lot of artists in an old cigar factory that they'd converted into El Samá. It was a artist studio. So Susan Taylor, the dancer, was there, and David Dye, and a lot of other artists, Rocky Kester, ceramic artists, painters, whatever. It was just sort of people were young and wanted a place to do their work. And Bud Lee was a wonderful photographer who shot for Esquire and Life, and he had a nervous breakdown and ended up getting a thing to teach artists in the schools in Hillsborough County, and he thought that would be a good way to, like, sort of get himself back together. He came, found Ybor, married, had four kids, and he became the big daddy. And his ideas, we all just wanted to help Bud make his ideas come true.
How did you meet Bud Lee?
I wish I could remember exactly, but Bud had put on the first sort of Artist and Writers Ball. It wasn't really well attended, and he had done it with, like, Q105. He would do anything. Bud would work with anyone. And so a group of us said, we really think we ought to do a satirical party, take fun of Gasparilla, and we love the idea of the Artists and Writers thing. So we met Bud. I think probably met him at Don Quixote, the restaurant where we planned everything. Everybody put in $100, those of us who had jobs, and the thing was sold out before showtime.
Don Quixote was in the was called back then the Centro Español.
Right. And the party we did was in Centro Español. It moved later to the Cuban Club.
Mm-hmm. So that would have been about late 79,
yeah. Maybe 80. I think Bud did one in 79. Maybe we came along in 80. The numbers start getting a little vague. We were not taking notes, Rob.
Yeah. So, and you started to sell tickets, and it boomed.
It went crazy, and there's a photo of me in the book in my Tribune, you know, outfit with a tie, and I've got a briefcase, and that briefcase was full of money, because in those days, what you did was put hard tickets at record stores and at La France and at places like that, and people would come and give cash, and there would be a big bags of cash. And so I was the guy who went around and picked up the cash, and I booked the bands.
You look like a bagman
I felt like a
organized
bag
crime.
It's true.
Yeah, because you're dressed in a tie there, and
I
look really official.
But, you know, Bud Lee and David Audette and a lot of other artists came together to create these giant, beautiful decor. The Cuban Club's completely transformed. And I booked bands to go on various floors, and it was just became this wild party. Thousands of people would show up.
This is really an eclectic group of people that attended these artists and writers balls. You guys were, would it be fair to say that you guys were kind of bohemian, the people that started the artists and writers ball and worked on it, or how would you describe where you at?
I think
culturally?
We were bored with our city. I had a band, and Tampa had one bar where bands could play, and we were all fighting to get into this, and it was a horrible bar. So one reason a lot of us came together was we wanted a place where we could play, our bands could play. And so other people wanted to do these art projects. And so it was just an oddball collection of people. And some of us had newspaper jobs. A lot of media people were involved. And then a lot of the artists from Ybor. And it hit some kind of crazy critical mass right off the bat.
People were hungry for this.
People were hungry for this.
We're talking with Paul Woodbourne about his new book, Cigar City, Tales from a 1980s Creative Ghetto. If you remember Ybor City in those days, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. The third co-conspirator in this, David Audette, who's still around, photographer.
Absolutely. We're doing an event together tonight.
Where
in St. Petersburg, at the Arts Exchange. I'm going to read from the book. Arts Exchange is in the Warehouse Arts District, and it's a wonderful spot, and David's going to show photos. We're doing a few things together.
He always had his camera with him wherever David went, it seemed.
He did. The only time he didn't was during the balls themselves. He gave it to somebody else because he knew he'd lose it. And so a lot of David's pictures are not of the ball. They're after the ball or before the ball. But he's got great pictures of the scene, and his pictures illustrate the book. Even though the book is fiction, we use his images, and Bud Lee has the cover shots.
Now, you had kind of an organic connection to the Ybor City community because your family was Italian, lots of Italian, Spanish, Cuban, German, Jewish families lived in Ybor City at the time, especially in the heyday. But was there a culture clash? Because you were, you know, you were not the typical denizens of Ybor City. You were young. It wasn't quite the hippie era. It was post the hippie era. But you were artists. You were free spirits.
People in torn jeans and flip-flops. And yeah, I remember I dated a girl who lived above the Ritz, and she was just the epitome of what an Ybor woman was in those days. She was going to HCC, but she spoke Spanish, too. Uh-huh. She was blonde, but she spoke fluent Spanish, and she would go into these clubs and hear these old Spanish guys playing dominoes, talking about these girls and all this stuff, and just ragging on all of these artists. And then she would wait till she was on her way out, and then she would reply to them in Spanish and say, I know what you're saying about me. But it was a pretty peaceful coexistence. They were happy to have the business, and you know, we were able to, people were desperate for something to happen, and we just started making things happen. I was telling people, you know, I'm in this modern arts world where we're 501c3s and we're filing our taxes. We never were a 501c3. We never pulled a permit. We never asked the city for a dime. You know,
you have thousands of people at these clubs, especially at the Cuban Club.
Right.
Did you have insurance?
We finally, after a couple of years, bought like $300 worth of insurance. And we had all these crowds. And so instead of thinking we ought to get real security people, Bud came up with the idea that, well, there's an umpire school in St. Petersburg, so we got like 12 young umpire trainees who were supposed to stand there and direct traffic. They panicked and fled.
So the crowd was too big.
At the end of every year, there were 8 or 10 of us who had done most of the work, and with whatever proceeds we hadn't left, we would take ourselves to Burns and order anything on the menu, which for us was like an incredible treat when you don't have money to go out to dinner normally. And the mantra was, well, we did it again and nobody died.
So were these artists and writers' balls supposed to be send-ups of the Gasparilla galas?
For some of us, yes. It was. We had debutantes one of the first years dressed as lizards. You know, we always had a coronation, sort of a mock coronation, and oftentimes the king was a queen. It didn't, you know, it was just fun, and I think Gasparilla was an easy target. And then we also always did it on the night of the night parade, so some of our biggest customers were pirates. They loved it.
Yeah.
They actually did a story about us in their pirate magazine one year about how great this party was that was making fun of them. So
people were encouraged to dress up in costumes. It wasn't come as you are.
There was always a theme, and and people just dressed for the theme.
What were some of the themes?
My favorite was Bad Taste in Outer Space. And people, it just opened itself up to massive stuff. But we had cowboys and Indians in love, Calhoun's Hawaiian Circus for the Poor, Disney Dolly. We never got sued by that one. We did a Disney Dolly mashup, and we kept waiting for the lawyers, but no one knew we were there.
Seems to me I remember one called No Depression or Depression
Era
Ball.
There was a Depression Ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that one, I booked a big band upstairs, and people were high-kicking to a big band and punking downstairs, and a big old Tampa big band from the 30s, 40s.
Because the straight people in Tampa had really abandoned Ybor City for the most part.
Oh,
there
yeah.
was a Columbia restaurant. There was a Silver Ring. The social clubs were still going in Tampa's Ybor City. But as you said, 7th Avenue was a ghost town at night in 1979.
Yeah, and the social clubs, there was not a lot happening there. They were desperate for us to come in and do some things. And the only other iconic thing, which appears a lot in the book, was El Goya, the big gay. It was more than a gay bar; it was like a gay mall, you know, and with 7 bars and a great drag show. And that
hung in there.
That hung in there. It became Tracks. It became a few other things.
That was world famous.
World famous, yeah. I thought, and I loved it because it was very it was friendly to anyone who came in and wanted to dance and have fun.
We're going to take some phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. We're talking with Paul Wilborn, who now directs the Palladium in St. Petersburg. But in the past, he has been a TV personality, a newspaper reporter, and he's written a new book called Cigar City, Tales from a 1980s Creative Ghetto. It's all about Ybor City in the late 70s and early 1980s. And this is WMNF in Tampa. You know, some of the grandest moments here on MNF were where you and Phil and Bill on the 60s show would send up the Gasparilla Parade, because there was a real, the parade in the 1980s was really exclusive. And I remember Phil and Bill sent you down as their correspondent.
See, I had completely forgotten. I love that. Yeah, I was there. I probably was covering it for the paper, too, at the same time, but calling in.
And you were calling in fake calls about all the crazy stuff the Gasparilla Pirates were doing.
I must have been a genius, because if you're remembering it, I'm glad you are. But it was Phil and Bill. I love their show. And, you know, M&F was so tied into all of that era, and I think it helped us publicize that.
Plus,
and,
we stole your idea. That's how we came up with Tropical Heat Wave.
Let's just say we gave it to you, because we did a party called Hot Night in Havana for about 2 years, and another reason for us to play a summer party, and that morphed into Tropical Heat Wave, and we were all happy it did, because you did all the work after that.
Do you take credit? Do the artists and writers and you, Paul Wilborn, do you kind of take credit for the revival of Ybor City, which is now an entertainment district that almost rivals Bourbon Street in New Orleans?
I think we do take credit for at least bringing attention back to it and restarting things. I think we all kind of dreamed it might be something other than what it became. I thought it would be more of a really hip, you know, historic district, and it kind of ultimately became sort of a lowest common denominator bar district, and that wasn't really what we envisioned. Though, you know, it's still fun. I like going down there. It's still kind of seedy, and I think Ybor's future is actually ahead of it. I see some good things starting to happen.
You used to live in Ybor City.
I did.
For a while.
Yeah. Not during the 70s and the 80s. The plumbing, but Rob, you know, I would visit these places, and I had friends who lived there, and I would house it, but the plumbing in these old Ybor apartments, I had a job, so I actually had a small apartment in South Tampa.
To shower?
Yeah, with a shower and with porcelain and things, you know, with not rust stains all over it. So, but I did, in the 90s, a few of us bought some shotgun houses, and we redid them, and I lived there for a couple of years. And
yeah,
it was great.
Some great neighborhoods. Well, yeah. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Let's go to Joe in Seminole Heights. Joe, you're on with Paul Wilborn on WMNF.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
What fun to talk about Ybor back in the day.
I'm having fun. Glad to hear your voice.
Yeah, good to hear yours, too. I remember from the first Artists and Writers, wasn't it Dante's Inferno, the thing?
I think that was Bud's first theme, and that was the one he did, I think, with Q105, Dante's Inferno, which, you know, how can you go wrong with that?
That's right. I can remember From Heaven All the Way to Hell.
That's right.
And Rocky, I was working at Gufu Studios.
Yeah,
so Rocky Kester had made these little round tokens. I still have mine.
Rocky made tokens for every ball for a number of years, and I've still got some of those tucked away. And I actually have my coffee every morning in a Rocky mug with Ybor on it.
Yeah, I've got some of his wall hangings.
Yeah, I've got a fictional character in the book who makes Ybor mugs and puts his name on the thing and puts Ybor on them. But I didn't. I kind of fictionalized folks here. There are a few folks appear like Roddy Reed and some others are backdrop characters. But all the main characters, I just wanted to have fun and see where they would go. So, and no lawyers will be calling me.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot. Joe, so you went to some of those Artists and Writers balls.
Yeah, the first one, and I remember David Pate was out in the front. He's a
wonderful saxophone player.
Yes, he is wonderful. He's with the house band Bogus Pump over at Dolly, and he does a lot of Frank Zappa, but he was out in the front playing the saxophone with a top hat upside down for tips. And let's see, there was Angelica's, Places, Rough Riders, Angelica's. I remember the parade. Rocky was the lead of the parade for the Girls from La France. I marched with them.
Yeah, we did Guava Weed. I think we did the crazy parade, and there were folks marching, and the Girls from La France and others.
That was also a satirical parade. That came a little bit later.
And it was a little separate from the Artists and Writers thing, but we were still, Mama Guava. We did that as a benefit for the Playmakers, which was an Ybor company that was in the Ritz. And Ritz at that point morphed from a porn palace where, when my girlfriend lived above it, literally you could hear the people moaning, you know, through the ceiling. And then it became, the Playmakers had their offices there and did shows at the Cuban Club. So that was really me the high point. That was where we thought Ybor was going. Theater companies and lots of things like that. It just kind of, I think, became not so less interesting.
Less hospitable to the artists. And,
yeah.
Right. Well, where can we get your book?
Well, thank you for asking. I'm doing an event at the Oxford Exchange, and it will be there either this week, I'm pretty sure. It's at Haslam's in St. Pete. It's at the Museum of Fine Arts in St. Pete. And it's on that giant behemoth called Amazon.
All right.
And I actually found myself on Kindle. I didn't buy my book on Kindle, but I did get the free preview.
That's great. That's right. All right, Joe, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you, Joe.
Let's go to Sahia, who's in Newport Richey. Sahia, thanks for calling in. You're on with Paul Wilborn.
Yeah, hi. I just want to let you know that I did live in Ybor City in the 80s, and El Goya was the first club that was down there. That was really a great time, and that was predominantly, they had drag shows there, and It was a great, if I'm allowed to say.
No, you can't say that. And if you say it again, you're going to be dropped. Sorry.
On the second floor, and I was a girlfriend of somebody, an artist who was a student of Theo's, Theo Watson,
from
USF. And he was kind of maybe even a rival competitor. He may not even be in the book for that reason. But his name was Steve Cable, and he did a lot of recycled artwork and managed punk and new wave bands.
Oh, sweet. I remember.
Yeah, like Miss Lucky's Backyard and this and the other. So after El Goya, he actually opened a place called Trendy's across from La France. And we cleaned up the whole second floor. The bathrooms were upstairs. People had walked through our bedroom and used them. And a lot of bands came and played there for about 6 months, but unfortunately he did not do it exactly on the up and up, because he didn't get any liquor licenses and was serving alcohol.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So, yeah, that's a big problem.
That was Ybor. I mean, people were just kind of making it up as they went along. We didn't really get in any trouble because the Cuban Club sold the alcohol, and we didn't ever touch alcohol. We touched it. We just didn't sell it. I will tell you, El Goya appears a number of places in the book, and we actually go into a drag show, and a lot of the drag artists, they're all, I fictionalized all of them, and I really fictionalized a lot of the artists as well.
Those were great days.
Yeah, those were great fun days.
They were fabulous days, and Trendy's was great while it lasted. I mean, a lot of the local bands came and played there, like The Chords and Ronnie and the Ray Guns, and all kind of like real grassroots bands. It was just like, it was a great time.
I booked a lot of those bands.
Yeah.
I booked a lot of those bands for the Artists and Writers Ball, and it was just fun because bands could actually play and lots of people could hear them. So that was a gunner good thing.
All right. Oh, Sahia, thanks
wonderful.
A lot.
Thanks.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you for
fun. Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Sahia. We're talking with Paul Wilborn about his book, Cigar City, Tales from a 1980s Creative Ghetto. It's all about the life and times of Ybor City in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and Paul is live here. Paul, you're going to be speaking this afternoon in St. Petersburg, and then you've got a couple more gigs.
We do. You know. We're doing some. I'm trying to do it with museums, which is great. We're doing the Arts Exchange in St. Petersburg, which is in the Warehouse Arts District tonight.
With David Audette
showing. And then Tuesday, we'll be at the Photo Museum in downtown Tampa for like 5 to 8, and David's going to be there showing photos as well, and we're going to kind of make it a party. And a few more things coming up. I'm doing the MFA, Museum of Fine Arts in St. Pete, their book club, and they're selling the book in their store. It's great.
Yeah, that's great. So you know, one of the best things about going to the Artists and Writers Ball were the decorations. Where did you guys get the decorations from for the Artists and Writers Balls in Ybor?
They were literally scavenged material and things made from, we had no budget. We never had any money going into these. So I remember going with Bud to they have a book depository school, Hillsborough County School, and it's like you could take stuff. They just said, here, this is all this leftover stuff. And so he would find crazy stuff in there that turned into decorations. We had art teachers had their little kids' projects with paper mache would be suddenly hanging all over the Cuban club. So, and David would come up with, he would build spaceships. I mean, we built like giant things that were revolving. I don't know how they did it. And there was no, we never had a budget. So it was just amazing. But total decor. I remember there was sort of a, you walked through, it was kind of a prehistoric ball or something, and you kind of walked through the Raquel Welch legs from that. Remember that movie?
I remember that famous
scene,
yeah.
It was literally outside the Cuban Club was completely an entrance that was created, faux entrance to come in.
It was complete, you
know,
fantasy.
I don't know how they did it. I tried to avoid all that part of it. That was the hard work.
Let's go to Henry in Ybor City. Henry, you're on with Paul Wilborn. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Paul.
How are you?
How doing, Rob?
Good.
I am born and raised in Ybor City and went to the schools there and had grandfather cigar worker. But I wanted to talk a little bit, since you were just talking about the decorations, my good friend Gilbert Flores, who unfortunately has now passed away.
One of my best friends, too. I loved Gilbert. I visited him many times in Key West, right? Losing him was like losing one of my best buddies. He was just a sad one.
Well, he was my best buddy. We went to Jefferson together. Both of us took mechanical drawings for many years over there, and we were the prize of the class being advanced in doing architectural designs, but he passed me up a long time ago.
And he helped decorate. He was really involved in a lot of those things because he was an architect and an artist, and those were the kind of people who came in, and Gilbert was just such a wonderful guy, too. Just loved him.
Yeah.
Died too young.
I do remember one Guavaween parade where I got a bunch of my political friends and people from Ybor City, and we made a float that was a lectores stand, and my son played the lector dressed up as a Cuban lectore, and I was the boss, and I was running around with a big top hat jumping up and down showing the anger that the cigar factory owners had with the lectores, and a little piece on the side. And the funny part is that there were some right-wing Cubans that were there, and they started following us and cursing at us and throwing things at the float during the parade, which I thought was great.
It was very successful. That's very successful. I was amazed. We sort of turned it loose to people to come up with these concepts, and there was wonderful stuff. We had the marching chamber music group. They would run up, sit down their chairs, play really fast, and get up and run to the next.
Well, I remember the Imelda Marcos shoe slaves.
That's right.
And so Imelda Marcos was back on a big throne. It was all about the reports that she and her dictator husband had a huge collection of shoes in the Philippines. It was
we had a
fantastic
whole group with little paper mache cars that did Del Mabry and Waters. That was their whole concept, as they were which was the most crowded intersection in Tampa at that point.
Henry, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Henry.
Well, one other last thing. Being half Sicilian, I always liked the morning nanas that were in morning clothes marching in the parade. That was one of my favorites.
Oh, I forgot about that, too. That's right.
All dressed in black.
All in black, very Sicilian. My part's Sicilian, too, so I know what you're talking about.
All right, Henry, thanks a lot. Thanks for those memories. Let's go to Joseph in Port Richey. Joseph, you're on with Paul Wilborn.
Yeah, back in 1979, I used to go to the Fourth Theater, which used to have the Alice people putting on plays.
There is a play in this book, and I was actually in an Alice people play at the Falk Theater called Cabaret. And
that was the best Richard Castellano.
Yes, yes.
The man died later on, but I remember the stairs going upwards.
Mm-hmm.
But to get to my point, I mean, Jeff Norton, Rosemary Orlando, Richard Hatch back in those days, and they splintered off into the Playmakers, and it was my first time going to the Cuban Club, which for me, gut it inside. I mean, gut it. Hardly any seats.
It was old school, man. But right. I actually got, my girlfriend from Ybor City was an actor, and my band had just broken up, and she said, I'm going to this audition for Cabaret. And so I drove her there, and I walked in the lobby, and they said, great, we need men. Go out and audition. And the worst part was, I got in, and she didn't.
Oh, no.
So it was kind of the end of the relationship there. But it was still, I had a great,
Was that Paul Wilborn and the Pop-Tarts?
Actually, no, that was before that. That was a different band, pre-Pop-Tarts. And I think that was called the Niagara Fools. And but I met Rosemary and I met Jeff and Richard and the choreographer, the great choreographer, Richard Castillo.
Well, Mark Hunter spent
so many
from Alice people. Yeah.
There's an story in
that
here.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, there's a story in here that's a takeoff on that. It's fictionalized and it's not Rosemary or Jeff, but it's about a production of Cabaret, and it's one of the stories in here. I think you'll enjoy it.
Because later on, Jeff tried to make it in New York and had to come back. I remember that. But what I always found interesting, it was my first time to Ybor, and I said, man, I hope we don't have no parking problems. There was no parking problems. In fact, the only people I saw was the ones going into Cuban Club for the plays, because I saw my best Jesus Christ Superstar.
I saw that production, too.
Yeah.
I think I played the piano in the lobby for that production.
All right.
Yeah, that was a great, those were great times. Thank you for remembering those shows.
Thanks, Joseph.
Thank you.
All right. You know, speaking of the Playmakers, I think it was them that did Evita at the Cuban Club. And Henry, one of our callers, talked about being attacked by right-wing Cubans, but I remember conservative Cubans were protesting Evita at the Cuban Club because there was a character in Evita, Che Guevara.
And I think they hung an American flag upside down or something. Yeah. And that Ricky Castillo was who I was thinking of, who choreographed a lot of those shows. He played Che in that production, and he was a choreographer at El Goya for the drag shows.
He was a great actor.
He was a great, and he a character inspired by him is in this book too, named Angel. And
the book is Cigar City: Tales from a 1980s Creative Ghetto, and its author Paul Wilborn is live with us today here on WMNF in Tampa. So, Paul, as part of your newspaper career, you uncovered the fact that people were being taken in by groups like Publishers Clearinghouse. Right.
Yeah, it was. I think the one that we really wrote mostly on, though they were all doing kind of the same thing, was American Family Publishers.
All right,
they had Dick Clark and Ed McMahon as their pitch guys, and I got a call at the newsroom one day, and an 84-year-old man had gotten on a plane in California, and his son had actually gotten on with him because he couldn't stop him from getting on, so he came with him. Because he thought he had won the sweepstakes and he was in a race with one other person, and the return address was Tampa.
Had he bought a lot of magazine subscriptions?
I never went to his house because he was in California. Yeah. But people were buying subscriptions for magazines they would
they would win the big prize.
And I wrote that story thinking it was maybe a unique, kind of sad, but one-off. Well, the airport police called and said, we've had 20 of those people here.
Flying to Tampa,
looking for Ed McMahon, getting off the plane and looking where they're expecting to be greeted. And so it turned out it was, I would go to senior citizens' houses and say, show me your room. And they would open a door and there was a room filled with magazines and filled with clippings. And we had people take them down to the Cadillac. They thought they'd want a Cadillac. And people kept flying in. It was literally out of control. If you didn't buy a magazine and you were in a race with one other person, you had to send your thing to Waycross, Georgia. How slow does that sound? But if you bought a magazine, it went to Tampa, Florida, which is the return address where everything is, and you could be a winner, and you're in a race.
And were these people being exploited?
I felt they were. Yeah. And I felt, they always paid out a sweepstakes. It was not like they weren't paying somebody when it's winning. But all around the country, people were hoarding and buying and putting all the stuff together. So I ended up doing a series of stories, and this wonderful guy in Bob Butterworth's office, assistant state attorney, got really angry about it. He took it up, and then suddenly like 30 other state attorneys got involved, and Congress, New York Times, did the same story on their front page, a two-part series. Congress changed the laws, and American Family went out of business. And if you look now at Publishers Clearinghouse, everywhere you look, it says no need to purchase to win in bold letters all over the place. So I think that those stories led to something good.
Paul Wilborn is a former reporter at the Tampa Tribune and also the St. Petersburg Times. He's out with a new book called Cigar City: Tales from a 1980s Creative Ghetto. It's all about Ybor City about three decades ago. And let's go to Patty, who's in St. Petersburg. Hi, Patty. You're on with Paul.
Hi, Paul. I'd like to thank you for the memories. I lived it, I loved it, and I miss it.
Me too. That's fun.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Patty.
Thanks, Patty. And John's in Sulphur Springs. John, you're on with Paul Wilborn.
Yeah, hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Paul, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I was a member of El Samal, along with, you know, David and Jerry, you know, those people. And I remember hearing you and the Pop-Tarts playing over at the old Rough Riders
place. Every Saturday night for a while, and you had to draw a crowd because nobody was there. We had to bring people.
The parking was free, though.
That's
that was
right.
The best part.
The El Samal Halloween party also shows up in the book as a backdrop for some characters' adventures. So you'll enjoy that, I think.
Was El Samal an artist group?
Yeah, it was an art colony. I mean, they literally carved up a cigar factory, which had also been a coffin factory, into artist studios, and they threw the best Halloween party. And that was kind of an inspiration for Guavaween later. When they stopped doing that party, Guavaween decided to do more of a public party.
So, John, you were part of that.
Yes, yes. And I remember playing the eerie music and people walking down in the basement and everything.
It was scary. It was scary. I think, as I remember, you walked in and they had put like foam on the floor, and you walking on this, like walking on marshmallows. It was and dark. It was very, you know, Friday
something
the 13th
squishy
kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, those were the days. It seemed like everybody knew everybody. I mean, you'd walk down 7th Avenue, you'd see, you know, Dan Stack or James Rosenquist. We'd go popping in the studio, you know.
Yeah.
Go get coffee, you know.
It really was a little community, and it felt so great. I was telling Rob, and James Rosenquist and I were actually dating the same girl, and we both knew that, which seemed okay, but then she left both of us for another guy. It was just so Ybor at the time, you know. But it was a small community where you saw everybody. It was fun. I don't know. I really think that was a magical time, and I was so glad I got to be there for it.
It was definitely. And, of course, all the meals were so inexpensive. I mean, Don Quixote's, it's like, you know, under $5, you get a half a chicken with rice and coffee and plantains, and you come out of there stuffed, you know. Then we'd go back to the studio and try to paint while you were falling asleep, you know, from the big meal.
I think you're going to enjoy this because there's a lot of stuff that reflects that period. And the food and the people and the craziness and it was what was great for me is you got to relive being in your early 20s without actually having to be in your early 20s again.
Exactly.
So I found that much very satisfying.
All right, John.
The late childhood is always great. Hey, whatever happened to Anna Tampana?
She's a Facebook friend of mine. She's married and living somewhere, not in town, but Anna seems to be doing great. I don't think she's wearing salad anymore. She was a human salad. Right. She would lay on a table and be covered in lettuce and tomatoes and dressing and things. She was the human salad.
And it would be real intimidating to take a piece of cheese or a lettuce.
Yeah, you had to be careful where you picked up
something.
That's a good memory. Thank
John,
you.
John, thanks a lot.
Okay, congrats.
Thanks. Appreciate
bye-bye.
It.
So Mike writes, he says, my first M&F gig, I'll never forget the prodigy Lucky Peterson at the age of 17 bringing down the house at the Columbia restaurant. My first Ybor City trip was to El Goya, where everybody was welcome. And the good times were when Ybor was sketchy. This was prior to the Dick Greco revisioning of Ybor City. So what do you think of things like Centro Ybor that have really changed Ybor City? Vastly different from what it was in the 1980s.
Well, we were actually hopeful about Centro Ybor, and I thought I didn't think that was a terrible renovation, and I think it was a real effort to keep it on a nice scale. I just think the zoning laws allowed bars next to each other, bars without food, and it kind of, I think that was the issue. You suddenly had these bars devouring each other, 3-for-1 drink specials. It went from being a kind of a hip neighborhood to being just, you know, the lowest common denominator, bad music. I had trouble finding a place I actually wanted to go on 7th Avenue after a while, and, you know, we had all kind of been envisioning just something else.
Yeah, I remember for a while there were record stores down there.
Oh, yeah.
And there was the
Three Birds
bookstore was down there.
I actually called Val Day, who was in... and said, look, I hope you don't mind, but I needed a bookstore. And so I moved Three Birds back into the early 80s. And she said, well, we opened in 1989, so really we qualify. I kind of moved some pieces around. I moved David Audette's Ground Zero to Ybor.
Yeah, well, just you used to be on Howard Avenue in Hyde Park.
Yeah. I just moved to Ybor for convenience sake. And so, because these were fiction, I felt it was easy to do.
Let's go to Greg, who's on Fort DeSoto. Greg, you're on with Paul Wilborn.
Yeah, hey, Paul, I seem to remember at the Bad Taste in Outer Space, Artist from Artist Ball, there was a law firm that was dressed up like a Martian travel agency, maybe like Colin the Knight, somebody like that.
I believe it. I don't remember it, but I believe it.
The costumes that party were the best, I think, of the whole time. That really brought out the best costumes.
That was pretty much about the best, you know, best thing. And the only thing that comes close nowadays is the group of 25 that do All Hallows Ball, you know, that you got to get on the who's who's list by somebody. So you got to know, like, Mark Nash or somebody.
Right.
He'll get you on the list so you get your, and even that's kind of gone downhill because it used to be they give you, like, that you wouldn't know what the theme was until the week before the event, but now they give you a couple weeks, or actually a couple months ahead of time, so you can plan your costume accordingly.
Yeah, I think anyway. The other thing that happened was we all got about 30 years older.
Well, yeah, but that gets you a lot more introspective and more, and you can plan, you know?
That's
you
true. We had a lot of fun, and those costumes, what was great was we believed this, when we started, that there was a real community of people who would turn out, but we didn't realize they really were turned out. Like thousands and thousands of people came out of Tampa because I think they were looking for something to do. Yeah. You know, the city was one of the things talk about in the book. The city had so much promise. They kept saying, "Oh, America's next great city," but the reality was Tampa was not America's next great city. It's only, I think, now really coming into its own. I'm really impressed. And I'm from Tampa. I was born in Tampa General, so I feel like I've got the privilege of saying, calling it like it is.
Being a service brat, I mean, I've been, you know, a lot of the spots, and actually I was born in the south side of Chicago, but, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm here. You mentioned Dick Recco and Central Ybor, you know, and the issue with that, with the cameras, I think, and with the security people not allowing people wearing hats a certain way and certain groups to congregate, and, you know, they were asked to leave in junk and that kind of.
Yeah, it just became city, I think it became something nobody quite expected.
There are parallels, I think, too, between what happened in Ybor City and what's happening on Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, too, because
it's true.
The artists and musicians and all that really populated Central Avenue before it became hip and groovy. Now they're all being priced out.
Yeah,
That happened before, and back in the boom, back in, say, 2005, and everybody's going to, you know, kick everybody out of their, you know, cheap storefronts, and we're going to put, you know, 15-story condo down there, and then when the market went south and everybody overbuilt, and if you wanted to get any money at all, you had to do federal funding with HUD for Section 8, you know, and then they invited all those people back, and now they're getting, like you say, getting priced out again, you know, so...
It's Florida, I think. Florida has this boom and, you know, boom and bust mentality, and I think Central, St. Pete is going through some of that stuff. Whenever I'm with a mayor or a city council person, I always tell the Ybor story. Don't do massive zonings of wet zoning. Require food. Restaurants with bars are much better.
Diverse businesses.
And be careful because all it takes is a little bit to kill that golden egg.
All right, Greg, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Mike writes this: I saw REM at the Cuban Club on New Year's Eve in 1981, writes Mike. I think that's about when the big changes began. It was more authentic back then. I used to drink at the Columbia every weekend. That was great times, writes Mike. Hey, I'm trying to remember, was there a hermit who lived in El Pasaje? Do you know this story?
He's in the book.
Okay, so tell me about the hermit in El Pasaje. Tell folks where El Pasaje is.
El Pasaje was where Cafe Creole became. It's next to the Cuban Club. It's one of the most, really the most beautiful building, in my opinion, in
it's
Ybor.
On 9th Avenue?
Between
Palm and 9th?
Yeah. And it's still there, red brick, just a wonderful building. And I met this guy, General Avinal, I believe was his name. And he actually shows up in the book as a real character. And he took me up to his lair. He was actually not really a hermit. He was just an old guy. And he believed in life extension. And he had all these life extension things that he would take, and I don't think it really helped him, but he was he wanted me to open. He said, all you have to do, sell Cuban sandwiches down in the corner, you will make a lot of money. And thank God I didn't believe him. But in that corner where he wanted me to do it became Cafe Creole, which was a wonderful restaurant for a long time. And he lived upstairs and eventually died, and I guess the building turned. But what inspired me for the story was there was a young artist gal who kind of looked after him. She would come and check on him and just make sure he was okay. And that inspired a story that had nothing to do with the reality of either of their lives, but it is the first story in the book.
Fantastic. That's in the El Pasaje's in the same block as the Cuban Club. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. The book is Cigar City. Paul Wilborn is our guest. He's the author. Let's go to David in Tampa. David, you're on with Paul.
Oh, hey. I was curious what Paul thinks about some of the chain stuff that's coming in, like Buffalo Wild Wings and 7-Eleven on 7th Avenue. And I feel like it's changing the character of Ybor a little bit.
I totally agree with you. I think historic districts need to be really careful not to become just commercialized chains. And, you know, it's tough because it's private property and people are looking for businesses that'll make it. But I think if you look at really good historic districts around the country, that's not the direction they go, and they find ways to have that not happen. So, you know, I like to see businesses thriving in Ybor, but those are probably, and I'm nothing against them, I just think chains are a dangerous thing to have in your historic district. There's plenty of room for chains outside of historic districts. It kind of cheapens the place a little more.
And I actually met Paul a while back in Seminole Heights. I was curious about what he feels about Seminole Heights and how we're doing here. That's where I live.
Oh, yeah, and we lived there for a long time and still own a house there. But what I did notice was as soon as I moved out, Seminole Heights started getting really hip. I don't know if it was me.
Yeah.
I think it was probably me. But we're happy. I'm really excited about what's happening, and I see some of that car lot property going. And I think the future is just wonderful for Seminole Heights, and we've actually held on to our house there because we love the house, and I really believe in the neighborhood. I'm excited about it.
Good investment, too.
Yeah, we were very lucky.
All right, David, thanks a lot. Let's go to Alex in Tampa. Alex, you're on with Paul Wilborn.
Hi, this is Alex. I just wanted to comment on some of the legacy left by some of that art from the 70s, particularly like the Alice people. Jeff Norton was a professor at USF when I was a student there, and we produced his show, Alice, and I was the designer and technical director for the show.
And I saw that show, and I fell in love with Rosemary Orlando in the audience like everybody did in that show.
Yeah. And Rosemary also. Rosemary still teaches. I'm actually now the technical director of the Falk Theater, and she directs shows for us at the University of Tampa. Yeah. And so it's still living on.
I'm still friends with her and Jeff Norton, you know, who was killed tragically. But his last show was at the Palladium, mm-hmm. and we hired him to do. He was hired to do a Web City production, and in typical Jeff fashion, you know, if you make $600, you have to report it. He said, "Paul, could you pay me $599?"
It sounds like Jeff. Jeff was also my landlord at one point in time, and I used to do work on his house, and I would actually do work on sets on shows he was directing in exchange for rent.
Jeff was the greatest. I miss him. Another guy that I was just one of my best buddies, and my life has not been nearly as much fun since he's been gone.
So, well, thanks. I just wanted to let you know that it's still strong, and especially in theater in Tampa Bay.
Oh yeah, theater
legacy,
is just
the Alice people's legacy. It's still running through everything. No, we do here.
It launched so much stuff. And those pioneering performers, and you look at the scene now with two Equity Theaters in St. Petersburg, StageWorks, JobSite. There's so much good theater going on. I can't see it all. It's too much.
Yeah,
it's great.
All right, Alex, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So back in the day, what were the rents like? You talked about how horrible the plumbing was above the Ritz in Ybor City, but what were rents like? Because I was looking at a new study. It's in Creative Loafing that says that you got to make at least $41,000 a year to rent a space that's the size of George Steinbrenner's closet, which is in today's paper. George Steinbrenner's closet was 600 square feet down there on Franklin Avenue, wherever that was, next to Palmacia. But what were rents like back there in Ybor City?
I was living in South Tampa, and I know I was paying for a nice apartment like $400 a month.
Yeah.
So I never rented Ybor until later, but I think people were paying like, you know, $100 a month or $200 and included utilities. You know,
was affordable.
It was affordable, and people shared. So, you know, it was you could afford it as a starving artist and to be able to do your art and have a place to live.
So we had potters, we had lamp makers, we had painters, we had all sorts of people.
Actors, students, just all over the place. Yeah. And it was just, I think people kept, there were not enough places for people to live. So people lived other places and came in for the scene too, because there was only so many places that were actually you could even rent if you wanted to. So
here's Amin writes, can you tell us anything about Santo Trafficante?
He was Italian.
Did he hang out in Ybor? That's what I didn't read the rest of it. I should have.
Okay. Well,
did he hang out in Ybor?
Not in the, if he did in the 80s, I didn't see him. I mean, he was, Santo was living in South Tampa at that point, and, you know, my family, go ahead.
No, go. I was going to say, you knew Patrick Mantega's father.
Oh, yeah.
Who hung out and
very well.
Had the corner table at the Tropicana.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the sad part is I've lived long enough where several people I knew are now statues. And when that happens, Rob, you know you're really old. But Roland was a close friend of mine, and I hung with Roland a lot. I was there one day. He always wore a white suit, and he made the mistake of ordering a meatball sandwich, and the juice, like the sauce, just landed on that red suit. It was horrible. Anyway, but.
He was the editor and publisher of La Gazzetta, yeah. The trilingual newspaper.
By the 80s, the mafia was not really a factor. There's a story in the book about, and this is sort of parallels today, the Marielitos, because that was a period where Castro actually sent, he emptied prisons and mental institutions and sent them to the U.S.
This is about 1980.
Yeah, there was a crime wave, and Ybor was at the heart of it a little bit until they rounded up those folks in Miami and Tampa and other places. But these were not typical refugees. This was on purpose dumping of criminals and put them on the boats with actual refugees.
There's a lot of speculation these days about prohibition and whether or not there were secret passageways in Ybor City.
Oh, there definitely were.
I'll
just tell one story. My great grandparents were Sicilian and had a dairy farm, and they had to sell their milk to what they called the white people. Because Sicilians, if you read anything about what was said about Sicilians and immigrants in general in the 20s, they were demeaned in the Tampa Tribune, everywhere. And the mafia actually, the milk processors would try to screw with them, and the mafia was their strength. So don't mess with me, because I got these guys. My grandmother became a Baptist, and she came home one day to the family home and couldn't get in her old bedroom. And she went around and looked inside. It was filled with booze during Prohibition. And she threw a fit and threatened to call the police. And my great-grandmother had to call the mob and say, "You've got to come get this booze out of here. Our daughter has become a Baptist."
Let's go to Greg in Brandon. Greg, you're on with Paul Wilborn.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Well, it's interesting. I'm actually pulled over on the side of the road. I just tuned in, and it just so happens I am starting a historical tour company in Ybor City. I landed in the Tampa region 15 years ago, and the first time I had a day off my job, I got lost, and I fell and found Ybor City, and I smelled, you know, cigars and coffee, and I'm like, I'm home.
That's right.
So I started doing ghost tours in Ybor about 6 years ago for another fellow, and I'm now starting my own company. And everything you're talking about is something I'm going to write a different, separate tour about. So I will be doing a ghost tour, but I'm really getting into the factual history. And a moment ago, you mentioned José Luis Avellanal is going to be one of my capstone stories.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of mafia. My signature tour is going to be the Era of Blood, the 20s through the 40s. And the capstone story of that one is the Victor Licata axe murder.
I just had coffee with Scott Deitch, I believe you say that right, who wrote Cigar City Mafia. Yep. He called me and said, "Well, one Cigar City guy to another, let's get together." And his book really documents that period. And, you know, this period that we're writing about sort of is a whole different era that what I like is no one's really written this story about Ybor.
Well, it's a great, great era. Greg, thanks a lot for your...
Good luck with your tours, man.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And by the way, I have your book. So,
thank you.
No, really. If there ever comes a time, I would love to actually sit and chat and have a nice cup of coffee.
I am easy to find, so track me down. I'll be happy to do that.
Absolutely.
All right, Greg, thanks a lot. Paul is the executive director of the Palladium. His book is Cigar City, Tales from a 1980s Creative Ghetto. It's all about Ybor City. Paul, thanks for coming by. This afternoon, you're going to be in St. Petersburg.
I'm going to be at St. Petersburg at the Arts Exchange with David from, I think, 6 to 8. And next Tuesday, we'll be at the Florida, the Photo Museum, FOMOPA, they call it, in downtown Tampa from 5 to 8. And they're all free. come on down and you can get books, and we'd love to meet you.
All right. Well, it's great to have you here. Congratulations on the book. This is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa. Frank Knox has been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lori. Have a great weekend. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play those comments back Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for Janelle Irwin. She's coming up next on the Midpoint program. This is WMNF in Tampa.